Hello and welcome to another episode of Damn Interesting Week. We are so glad you've decided to join us. My name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And this was a damn interesting week. So let's get started with our first link.
First link.
From fizz.org, chemists have created the world's thinnest spaghetti.
Wow.
I'm going to assume it's not for eating, or is it?
Well,
okay.
Have you guys ever heard of the special threads of God pasta that's made in like a specific place in Italy? Like only 5-10 people know how to do it.
I have actually.
No.
I don't know why I have that in my brain. There's no reason, but I do know something about that. Yeah.
Maybe it was a previous episode, but it's called Sufilindu or Threads of God. It's made by hand. And it's specifically in the town of Nuoro, Sardinia in Italy. So it's long pasta. It's basically hand stretched, almost like taffy, but it's estimated at about 400 microns wide. And it's tiny, right? But even that is 1,000 times thicker than this new nanopasta. There's a picture if you want to see it, but it's about 200 times thinner than a human hair. That might actually be a better reference point. It's been created by a research team not to be a new food, but because of potential wide-ranging uses that extremely thin strands of material might have in medicine and industry. They're hoping that these might be used in bandages to aid with wound healing, in part because these nanofiber mats, what they do is they spin it out and then they create a mat by kind of hashing them and weaving them crosswise. These are highly porous, so water and moisture can get in, but bacteria stay blocked out, which is huge, right? Like 3D printing your own dissolvable, delicious pasta-flavored Band-Aid.
Are you saying I can use pasta noodles for bandages?
No, we're not. So be careful. Don't drink the bleach. Don't use pasta as a Band-Aid. But there are a few more steps to get there. And part of that is looking at where we've been, because normally we have nanofibers that are made of starch that are produced by green plants to store extra glucose and make starch this way. We have to get the starch from them by extracting it from plant cells and then purifying it, which is a really energy and water intensive process. So they looked at this pasta experiment as a more environmentally friendly method. Now, they use this technique called electrospinning. This is so wild and made me think of cotton candy.
Mm.
Effectively, threads of flour and liquid are pulled through the tip of a needle by an electric charge. And that sort of extruded the material, which, you know, is how pasta is made, right?
Yeah, it's like that Play-Doh toy I had when I was younger where I could squeeze it out.
That's exactly right. And in fact, in the paper, Dr. Adam Clancy, co-author, said, quote, "To make spaghetti, you push a mixture of water and flour through metal holes."
Mm-hmm.
In our study, we did the same, except we pulled our flour mixture with an electrical charge. It's literally spaghetti, but much smaller, end quote. I love that that was in a paper. So the novel nanopasta, it formed a mat of nanofibers around 2 centimeters across. So you can see it, but not the individual strands.
Mm.
So they're thinking they also might be used as scaffolding to regrow tissue, because these starches mimic the extracellular matrix, which is a network of proteins and other molecules that cells build to support themselves. It's also just a promising material, starches, because it's abundant, renewable. It's the second largest source of biomass on Earth behind cellulose, which kind of blew my mind.
Hmm.
But it's also biodegradable, which means it can be broken down in the body. But purifying starch has a lot of processing. So hopefully using flour would reduce the energy and water needs for purification. We also need to investigate how this actually works in situ. For example, we want to know how quickly it disintegrates, right?
Mm-hmm.
How it actually interacts with cells. Are there any effects that we need to be aware of? And also, is this even something that could be produced at scale? But, you know, if you got the formula in a 3D printer that has, you know, an electro spinner extruder, why not? Go crazy.
Right. And if you used a bandage like that for somebody who was celiac,
You're right.
That do.
Yeah. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think the grannies would definitely argue that if it doesn't have egg in it, is it really pasta or is it glue? Like this, I don't know. I, at a minimum, I'm going to argue, I bet it doesn't taste good.
No. The professor who is commenting on this said, quote, "I don't think it's useful as pasta, sadly, as it would overcook in less than a second before you could even take it out of the pan."
Wow.
But might be able to slap it on a wound, call it a day, fingers crossed.
Maybe it cooks in blood, too. So it...
We're going to find out that this is actually how you summon the Pillsbury Doughboy in demon form.
Very nice.
Next link.
Next link.
This article comes to us from Popular Science titled "Great Apes May Have Cognitive Foundations for Language, So Why Haven't They Evolved Languages of Their Own?"
Laziness.
Yeah.
Well, maybe we just don't understand them. Maybe it's like a series of eye rolls.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I imagine that they've been watching humans for a while, and they're like, that's just too much trouble. We see where that road leads.
They're smart enough to learn from our mistakes.
Yeah, exactly. So you see a cat chasing a mouse, you probably don't realize it, but as soon as you catch sight of this scene unfolding, your brain makes a key distinction between the cat and the mouse. It identifies who's chasing and who's being chased. This capacity to distinguish between the agent, the entity performing the action, and the patient, the entity upon which that action is being performed, is called event decomposition, and it's long been thought that this was a unique ability to humans. But a new study published in PLOS Biology on November 26th suggests that this is not the case. Great apes, specifically gorillas, chimpanzees, and orangutans, also seem to track events in the way that we do, distinguishing between agent and patient. This finding is notable because scientists believe event decomposition lies at the heart of something that is unique to humans. It's no coincidence that the concepts of agent and patient bear a strong resemblance to the linguistic concepts of subject and object. Vanessa Wilson, the paper's lead author, explains to Popular Science that her team set out to answer a key question: is our capacity for language predicated on the ability for event decomposition, or vice versa? To do this, the team played the apes a series of video clips tracking the apes' eye movements as they watched. They found that, just like humans, the apes' attention moved back and forth between agent and patient, which implies that they share our ability to distinguish the two. This suggests that the capacity to decompose events evolved first, and that it provides a cognitive foundation for language. So, if they possess the cognitive framework to evolve language, why have apes not done so? Wilson explains that the answer to this question remains unclear. One proposal, she says, is that our social cognition played a role in human language development, and our need for social cooperation drove this externalization of how we perceive and make sense of the world. Humans also have significantly larger brains than our closest primate relatives, and one theory is that our complex social interactions, of which language is a key part, is at least part of the reason why. This, of course, is another chicken and egg question. Did we evolve large brains to facilitate the use of language, or were we able to develop language because of our large brains? Again, Wilson says the answer isn't entirely clear. I doubt that we could ever say that one led to the other. If larger brains were beneficial for computation that led to language, then there's likely to have been a selection pressure that continued to drive brain size and communicative complexity in a kind of feedback loop where the pressures of language require increasing brain size, and increasing brain size is beneficial to language.
Yeah.
The paper notes another possibility. While other animals might be capable of human-like event decomposition, they simply do not have the motivation or resources to communicate about agent-patient relations. This raises the question of why early humans did have that motivation. How and why did language evolve out of the more basic methods of communication, like simply grabbing a fellow gorilla's arm and pointing in the direction of food? But this also raises a more fundamental question. At what point does communication become language anyway? Wilson says that this question is one over which linguists and biologists continue to debate, and that the line isn't as clear as one might think. Having said that, she explains that there are several features of human language that set it apart from other forms of communication. One of these features is compositionality, our ability to combine words of individual meaning into different orders which in turn produce their own specific meaning. Another unique aspect is recursion, our ability to form nested hierarchical structures, which is thought to be the basis of syntax. One theory is that this emerged as a response to a growing lexicon. There was an upper constraint on a growing number of signals, so syntax allowed us to combine these signals more easily. Ultimately, though, the more we learn about animals and the ways in which they communicate and the cognitive mechanisms that underlie those forms of communication, the more we come to understand that humans are perhaps not as unique as we might like to think we are.
Yeah, which, I mean, it makes sense that, like, especially the part where they're like, oh, what about gestures being a different form of communication? I think all forms of communication are understood to support each other, right? Like babies that learn sign language acquire verbal language faster, which you wouldn't, like some parents are afraid of that.
Yeah.
But they've shown, no, it doesn't cause them to not learn to speak. It causes them to speak better.
Yeah, we can do some really amazingly complex things with language. But when we rely too much on it, we neglect other forms of communication.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes the only thing that's called for is a middle finger. They understand what I meant.
Yeah, I bet an orangutan knows exactly what a middle finger means.
Oh, I think most of them do.
Next link.
Next link.
Okay, this comes from the conversation, and I guess this is cautionary for the holidays.
Uh-oh.
Why you should never kiss a baby. Other than the obvious potential jail sentences, there are health reasons. Okay, there is a cognitive bias called the curse of knowledge, sometimes also called the curse of expertise. It happens when you incorrectly assume that everyone knows as much as you do on a given topic. As a clinical microbiologist, Dr. Karan Raj assumed everyone knew that it was a terrible idea to kiss a newborn baby anywhere on its head. He recently made a TikTok warning people of the dangers of kissing a baby. And judging by the thousands of comments, this was news on the social media platform.
What a hot take. Way to get the viral hits for actual knowledge.
Right, and actual viruses.
It went viral, but late last year, a UK charity called the Lullaby Trust published a result of a survey which revealed that 54% of new and expectant parents would, quote, let friends and family kiss their newborn baby unaware of the risk of serious infection. Why is it so dangerous to kiss a newborn? As we can imagine, a baby's immune system is not fully developed when they are born, so risk of catching a serious infection is much higher. For the first 3 months or so, the infant's immune system has fewer innate infection-fighting immune cells, which means that infections that cause mild symptoms in adults or older children can be life-threatening for babies. Let's not forget, as we often do, about herpes. In adults, herpes cause cold sores, but babies can quickly become seriously ill after catching the virus. If the herpes only affects the baby's eyes, mouth, or skin, most will recover after antiviral treatment. But if the virus becomes systemic and affects the baby's organs, the infection is much more serious and can even be deadly.
Aww.
They're also susceptible to E. coli. These can have serious outcomes.
They're babies. They're like little human larvae. Oh my gosh.
So what do you do? You put them in a plastic bubble, of course.
No!
No.
Just wash them with bleach, guys.
No!
So what they recommend here is that parents of young babies shouldn't feel uncomfortable about asking visitors to avoid kissing or touching their child. If the visitor really cares for the well-being of the infant, they should not feel offended by this request.
Ugh.
And the parents shouldn't feel that they are overreacting.
Yeah, in a perfect world where people still have honor and... sorry.
It's a very Klingon way of looking at it. You have no honor when you kiss this baby.
Well, some people, as COVID has shown, will value making sure that they get that connection they need, even if it means risking the health of somebody who has, I don't know, a lowered immune system. So
right. So if you are compelled, as some people are, to touch and kiss the baby on the foot or the back of their head is the recommendation.
And listen, kissing baby's feet is really good, y'all. I'm not mad about this.
It's probably the cleanest foot you'll ever kiss.
For sure.
Right. So just do what I do and just avoid babies altogether.
That's another way to do it. Yeah.
And you are good to go. With that cautionary tale, next link.
Next link.
All right. Well, this is very on point and still very related. This next article comes from The Guardian and it's called Why Do We Kiss?
Oh,
hey.
To spread herpes, obviously.
Apparently. And they do admit right off the bat, the answer is we don't know. We've got a lot of theories, but no definitive answers. And now things have gotten even less definitive because a new theory has just been added to the mix.
Ooh.
So starting with what we do know, which itself does debunk some of the theories we've held in the past, so we are making progress at least. But one thing we know for sure is that romantic kissing dates back to at least 4,500 years ago, because we have found cuneiform writing from Mesopotamia that describes kissing as a normal part of romantic intimacy.
Wow.
Yeah, they don't, like, transcribe that text, so I'm not sure if this was, like, you know, fanfic for, like, I don't know. I don't know what this was. And that right there gets rid of one of the more crackpot theories that I personally have heard, which is that ancient Greek men supposedly developed the habit of tasting their wives' lips to see whether they'd been dipping into the alcohol while the men were out. Have y'all ever heard? I heard that one when I was younger.
Yeah.
Anyway, that one's definitely in the trash and good riddance. But we're also pretty sure that romantic kissing didn't just spontaneously appear in Mesopotamia one day. And there is a fair amount of evidence, though again, not conclusive, for kissing as an evolutionary practice that goes back to before humans were even humans.
Mm.
To start with, and this is very relevant to your part, Bradley, a 10-second kiss transfers about 80 million bacteria between individuals, as well as certain proteins and cells that could theoretically give you a subconscious assessment of a person's health and immunological profile, and thus their suitability as a reproductive partner. Right? What's dangerous for a baby might actually be good information from an adult.
Mm-hmm.
Saliva also contains testosterone, leading some to suggest that kissing might be a direct method of increasing the drive to mate in both partners. Also, one study of 26 couples found that increasing the frequency of kissing in their relationship led to a reduction in cholesterol for both partners.
What?
Huh.
Yeah. So one way or another, it is definitely healthy for us to kiss adults. And more to the point on the evolutionary question, scientists have observed mouth-to-mouth kissing behaviors in bonobos as well as chimpanzees.
Hmm.
Crucially, however, ape kissing is not generally part of mating or restricted to romantic partners. In chimps, actually, it usually happens between males as a form of reconciliation after a fight, which I hope someone from the UFC has taken notes here, because we should institute that immediately. That would totally
change the game.
That fanfic
already exists for sure.
Right, exactly. But the thing is, if you look at pictures of chimps kissing, like assuming that's your thing, it's honestly more of a general mouthing all over each other's face activity.
Data transfer.
Right. And so a lot of anthropologists say this isn't the same as romantic kissing, and they reject all the evolutionary explanations for the simple reason that if it's evolutionary, romantic kissing would be universal across human cultures, and it turns out it is not. Back in the 1970s, an Austrian ethnologist named Irenaus Eibel Eibesfeld, he claimed that romantic kissing was present in about 90% of human cultures. But in 2015, William Jankowiak at the University of Nevada released a study showing it was actually more like 46%.
Hmm.
Jankowiak cites, for example, the Mehinaku, an indigenous people of Brazil, for whom it is well documented that when they first saw Europeans kissing, they were disgusted by it. And if you really want to dig into it, Jankowiak actually found a correlation between less clothing and less kissing, where cultures who had to bundle up because of cold weather were far more likely to exhibit romantic kissing than tropical cultures where people wore comparatively little. Hmm. And, you know, his idea there is maybe if you're all covered up, the face is the only thing available, so you're going to work with what you have.
Well, that, you know, if you're hot and sweaty, it's...
There's a lot of bacteria being transferred passively, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, however, both the 1970s and the 2015 studies found that kissing between parents and children is universal. So advice or not, mamas kiss their babies in 100% of cultures.
Hmm.
And that potentially ties in to the new theory I alluded to at the beginning, which is a documentation of grooming behavior in apes that involves not just sort of mouthing against another individual, but specifically puckering the lips and using a little suction motion to pluck parasites out of a child or a partner's fur.
Mm.
So the author of that study, Adriano Lamera, says this motion is much closer to what we would think of as a kiss and is therefore a more likely origin than, for example, another theory called premastication, where mother apes and other creatures will sometimes chew food for their infants and then put it directly in their mouths. He says, that's not a kiss. Face mouthing is not a kiss. This grooming behavior is a kiss.
Hmm.
So what about tongue? when the French invented that.
Well, so actually, the bonobos are all about the tongue. Like, that's how they kiss is like. They've said it almost looks like a form of fighting in and of itself. Like, they aggressively go after each other with their tongues.
I was thinking of in Vietnamese or Southeast Asian cultures, I think even in Thailand, there's something called the Vietnamese kiss or the sniff kiss. And it's usually just within families, but it's you basically like give a really sharp inhale through the nose. Like you huff the person's scent effectively, which feels like, I guess, a more dry version of what the kiss is supposed to represent.
Well, and like the Inuit kind of famously do nose rubbing without involving the lips, but it's that very face-to-face intimate behavior. And a lot of the other researchers who are quoted in this article do seem to be okay with the idea that, yeah, maybe parent-child kissing, kinship kissing is where these evolutionary origins lead. But they say, again, that's still markedly different from romantic kissing, which is not universal and we still can't explain it. So, you know, I mean, it seems like a field where just about anything can still get some traction. So if you've got your own theories, you know, don't be afraid to put them out there because everybody else is. Next link.
Next link.
From the Smithsonian, I guess we're staying with bodily fluids because we found a 2,000-year-old mug and were able to analyze the contents. And yeah, it got psychedelic, y'all.
Oh.
And this is a mug that was intricately crafted that we were able to 3D replicate, but it depicts the ancient Egyptian deity Bes. This is an Egyptian god associated with joy, fertility, and household protection. Mm. They were thinking it was probably used around the 2nd century BCE during the Ptolemaic era. And it was donated to the Tampa Museum of Art's collections in 1984. So it's been resting there. Mm. And we've been speculating for a really long time when it comes to mugs with the head of Bes, what was inside of it, what it may have been used for. They were thinking, you know, sacred water, milk, wine. You know, we just weren't sure if these mugs were used just like everyday mug or super sacred ritual. But in the recent study, scientists conducted an advanced chemical and DNA analysis of the mug. The psychedelic components they found included Paganum harmala, also known as Syrian rue. The seeds of that plant can induce dreamlike visions. They also discovered traces of Egyptian lotus, which is a mild sedative that causes feelings of euphoria. Sounds pretty good so far. But in addition to the psychedelic residue, they found the cup contained traces of a variety of substances, including alcohol, honey, sesame seeds, pine nuts, licorice, grapes, and the presence of what may have been human blood and other bodily fluids, because, you know.
Oh, what... cool. Hmm. This just went from a psychedelic wine to something very different.
To a sacramental wine. Very good.
Yeah.
Now, this might not have been something everybody would want to or would get to drink, but co-author Enrico Greco, a chemist at the University of Trieste in Italy, said that maybe these ingredients had served an important purpose, because specifically they found proteins from blood, vaginal mucus, and possibly even breast milk. So these fluids, they're thinking, may have held some kind of symbolic or ritual significance, because remember, the themes of life, fertility kind of all thematically fits there. But they weren't expecting that. So the inclusion of human fluids, quote, was an unexpected and highly symbolic element. So they think maybe with this new knowledge that we have, maybe the mug was used for something like an incubation ritual in which people would sleep in a sacred area and hope to receive guidance from a deity. For example, in the Greek cult of Asclepios, god of medicine, sick worshippers had to spend the night in the sanctuary and wait to be visited by the god, curing them during their dreams. So those dreams were triggered by drugs, or in the Greek word, pharmaka.
Mm.
So this research might be confirming an earlier practice that has later comparisons in many other cultures. So going forward, they plan to examine other known Bes mugs. Like, was it just this Bes mug? We got other, like, what are the recipes, right?
Was there one freaky priest and the rest were normal?
Or, I mean, I have another theory.
Mm.
I've used a mug for other things other than...
Right, right. Maybe they just weren't washing it very well. It wasn't intentional. Right.
It was
right.
not a drinking like one, vessel. Like, it was a holding vessel.
We got to clean this up real quick, okay. right? Grab the nearest thing. Grab the nearest thing. And they grabbed that mug and they cleaned up some stuff and then they rinsed it out.
We just got to test more best mugs and get those Boris mugs and the Ma'at mugs. Whatever we need to do to figure it out. Next link.
Next link.
This article comes to us from thedebrief.org. It's titled, Buried Beneath Arctic Ice, a Secretive Underground Military Base Emerges in New Radar Images.
Surprise?
Yeah. Now, a bit of a spoiler. This isn't like a new military base installation that was like newly discovered. This is an old one. But when it first appeared in their radar images, NASA scientist Chad Green and his team of engineers weren't sure what they were seeing. Green and his crew were monitoring radar information collected from the ice sheet below when, about 150 miles east of Pituffik Space Base, formerly Thule Air Base, and still the northernmost installation operated by the U.S. Armed Forces, they spotted something unexpected. A remote U.S. military base once used as a top-secret testing site for the deployment of nuclear missiles from the Arctic, Camp Century was constructed by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers within the Greenland ice sheet in 1959. Remaining in use for less than a decade, the base was decommissioned and abandoned beneath Greenland's frozen landscape. Also known as the City Under the Ice, this forgotten Cold War relic consists of a network of tunnels hewn into the near-surface portions of the ice sheet. Today, the remnants of the secretive base lay hidden beneath close to 100 feet of snow and ice that have continued to accumulate since it was decommissioned. So, this wasn't the first time the U.S. military's forgotten Cold War stronghold in Greenland had been detected during airborne surveys. In the past, aircraft using ground-penetrating radar have also detected signs of the hidden underground facility, albeit resembling little more than a small disturbance within the surrounding deformed layers of ice. Unlike those past surveys, in April when Green, Gardner, and their NASA crew passed overhead, they were armed with the space agency's uninhabited aerial vehicle synthetic aperture radar, or UAV SAR, a radar system mounted directly to the underbelly of their aircraft that enables enhanced radar imaging capabilities. Green said, in the new data, individual structures in the secret city are visible in a way that they've never been seen before. However, as melting continues to wear away the Greenland ice sheet, scientists are aware that it could someday be exposed once again, meaning that any radioactive waste and other potentially harmful chemical or biological waste that was left behind in 1967 could also resurface.
That means the ancient aliens can get out. That's bad.
Yeah. I mean, you know, they've been under there since the 60s. I bet they're pissed.
They're pissed.
Yeah. The radar imagery of Camp Century obtained by Green and Gardner was showcased at the Image of the Day for November 25th, 2024 at NASA's Earth Observatory website. So if you want to see some more of those images, there's some other cool internal shots of the actual trenches. You can check that out there.
I mean, it sounds like there's an argument to be made that this is an oblique threat to any supervillains who have underground ice layers, where you're basically admitting, hey, we can see you now, because we already knew it was there. It's not like it's a shock to admit that we used to have this compound. Mm-hmm. It's really more bragging. It's them going, man, look at how good we are and how much better we can see it now than we used to be able to. Just watch out. Like. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and they're like, oh, you know, this is important for science, but really they're like, check out our cool radar, guys.
Right.
Yeah. They had to justify it with a grant after the fact. So they were like, we did a bunch of scanning. What can we claim this was for?
Next link.
Well, somehow I'm going to combine NASA and bodily fluids.
Hey!
A study says human hibernation could be possible if we harness the power of bat blood.
Oh, because bat blood has worked out so well for us in recent years.
Yes. If we have any hope of becoming a star-traveling civilization, we need to either develop some kind of warp drive or develop some way to hibernate. NASA's known this and has looked into the idea for years, even studying the hibernating habits of Arctic ground squirrels. And over the course of that prolonged study, they found that while it isn't necessarily biologically impossible, any human hibernation would likely be medically induced. Now, a new study from scientists in Germany, led by Gerald Kurth, have turned elsewhere in the animal kingdom for inspiration and studied the hibernating prowess of bats. Through their research, they discovered that a type of red blood cell called an erythrocyte could play a major role in inducing hibernation. And hibernation's a handy biological tool. The strategy can be seen across the animal kingdom, even occurring in the summer in a process known as estivation. That's not to be confused with de-estivization, which happened to both Martin and Charlie. Sorry, that was a
really
my bad
God,
joke.
That took me so long.
Oh my gosh.
Estevez, right, Martin and Charlie. Anyway.
Thank you. All right. Considering that the closest star is 4.24 light years away, even if humanity could somehow travel through space approaching the speed of light, it'd still take years off of our human existence just to visit. So in this study, Kurth and his team analyzed hundreds of thousands of erythrocytes from hibernating bats and non-hibernating bats, as well as samples from humans. The team eventually discovered that when the internal temperature dropped from 99 degrees Fahrenheit to 73 degrees, all three species showed a blood cell transformation. However, as scientists continued plunging the temperature down to 50 degrees, the bat cells from both the hibernating and non-hibernating species continued the cellular transformation, while the human blood cells just stalled out. Although deep space travel is far, far from the future, the team notes that changing the mechanical properties of human blood cells could help optimize blood circulation for pharmaceutical means in the much near future. For example, surgeons already employ a method known as deep hypothermic cellulary arrest. Let's just call it DHC, in order to stop brain function and circulation for certain types of major surgeries. And of course, there is still a long way to go. This is just in the beginning of them researching this. This is far future tech. But for me, it shows that we've got a lot more to learn about and fix on this planet if we're going to go to the stars in the future.
I mean, they don't mention the other option, which is wormholes.
Yeah.
Totally.
Mm-hmm. Or something that some brilliant person 100 years from now is going to think of that we have no idea was a thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To the future.
All right. Well, that is all we have time for today. We're so glad you've joined us. Some of the articles we did not have time to get to today include Europe's strangest unsolved mystery, when a telescope is a national security risk, and you're probably wrong about rainbows. So all that and more, plus everything we talked about today, can be found on DamnInteresting.com. If you like our podcast and want to support us, you can do so at patreon.com/DamnInteresting Week. In the meantime, my name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And we hope you have a damn interesting week. Bye-bye.